Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, an American Airlines plane with a Charlotte-based flight crew and a Charlotte passenger crashes into the Potomac on approach to National Airport. There are no survivors. The still-contested Riggs Griffin race for a seat on the state Supreme Court has its day in the Fourth Circuit Court. Mecklenburg County is short on cash. Could there be another property tax increase? Some middlingly good news for CMS readers. The General Assembly is in session with an eye toward Hurricane Helene relief, and North Carolina fights back against some moves by the Trump administration. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE Senior Editor Eli Portillo. Nick Oxner is Chief Investigative Reporter for WBTV. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV, and Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back.
Good morning.
On Wednesday evening, American Airlines Flight 5342 crashed on its first or final approach to Reagan National Airport in Washington following a collision with a military helicopter. Everybody knows this now, but there were 64 passengers and crew on board the plane arriving from Wichita, Kansas, three flight crew members on the helicopter, and there were no survivors. I believe it was CBS News. It was the first to report the two pilots, and now later the flight crew was based out of Charlotte. But just because the flight crew is based here doesn't mean that they live here. What do we know about these four individuals? Pilot Jonathan Campos, First Officer Samuel Lilly, and the two flight attendants, Ian Epstein and Denisha Elder. What do we know about them?
Well, I believe the flight attendants, we've confirmed that they actually did live in Charlotte area from here. And the pilots, as of this morning, I'm not sure. I know some of they had Georgia and Florida ties. We also know of a passenger, Wendy Jo Schaefer, who was a mother of two and lived in Charlotte, who was on that flight and passed away.
I think all but one of them had children, and Wendy Schaefer, the passenger, was a mother of two boys, a three-year-old and a one-year-old. This is a tragedy, unspeakable tragedy for that family and everybody else involved in this. The plane was operated by PSA. That's a regional airline, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of American Airlines, which has hubs in both Washington, D.C. at Reagan National and, of course, here in Charlotte. And Robert Isom is CEO of American Airlines.
Our focus right now is doing everything that we can to support all of those involved and also the PSA Airlines team. This is devastating. We are all hurting incredibly.
I guess the big news about some of the people on board the plane has been focused on the fact that a lot of figure skaters, well-known figure skaters and up-and-coming young figure skaters, 13 years old, 14 years old, were on that plane, many from the Boston Skating Club. What about, has anybody talked about other passengers? Because they were probably from all over the country.
I've seen reporting about passengers who were returning from hunting trip together, passengers who were on business, kind of just your average 60-person jet with people on a variety of trips. One passenger I was reading this morning was on her way back to Washington after going to Kansas to assist her mother with surgery. So, you know, just the wide stretch of lives that are on any plane. And in one weird twist I wanted to mention, actually several hours before this crash happened, PSA, the wholly owned subsidiary that operates these flights, announced that they are relocating their headquarters to Charlotte. So, yeah. Obviously we were, the city was very excited about that. And then this tragedy happened right after in a weird twist of timing.
One thing that to me was interesting is we have so few of these air crashes anymore because airline travel has become so safe in recent years that this is an anomaly, one hopes. And even though this country goes through tragedies
almost every day, particularly when it comes to school shootings and things like this. This seems to have captured people's attention. Usually these go away after the six-hour news cycle is over, and we don't speak of it much anymore. This has captured the nation's attention. Why?
Yeah, I think it's probably, Mike, the slow leak of information. There's the initial shock that comes out Wednesday night and Thursday morning as people are waking up. And then you start to get the slow trickle of information about these people. I was just reading about Wendy Schaefer earlier. And you read the GoFundMe for her, which is now above $200,000. And you read the description of her and her husband and their two kids. And you think, as much as I'm sure the family had help, someone had to write this in the last 24 hours, having no idea they would ever be charged with this. It's one thing if somebody is, you know, elderly or old or something like this, but this was a young mother. And whoever had to write this, almost like an obituary on the GoFundMe about who she, I just think to myself, I nod myself, like, how could you do that? Like, you were talking to her probably 12 hours ago, and now this.
Yeah. As national media have pointed out repeatedly, D.C. airspace is among the most crowded and highly regulated in the country for obvious reasons, and the flight paths into and out of Reagan National are difficult given airspace restrictions in place to protect the nation's capital. It's also an area where lots of helicopters are coming and going because there are so many military bases in close proximity to the airport. And almost immediately after the crash, Donald Trump indulged in an unhelpful, speculative, and unpresidential posts on Truth Social, insisting that the crash was preventable. Perhaps it was, we don't know that yet, and questioning why the helicopter traveled straight, because this is a quote, straight at the airplane for an extended period of time, adding, why didn't the control tower tell the helicopter what to do instead of asking if they saw the plane? And yesterday, at a gathering in the White House press room, Trump took a different approach to what other presidents have said following tragedy, blaming the crash on Presidents Obama and Biden and their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, reminding reporters that he made changes in hiring practices following Obama, and that he says that raised the standards so that only the best people could be air traffic controllers.
And then when I left office and Biden took over, he changed them back to lower than ever before. I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first. And they put politics at a level that nobody's ever seen, because this was the lowest level. Their policy was horrible, and their politics was even worse.
Clearly, more to learn from this ongoing investigation of the nation's worst crash since 2009, which coincidentally occurred, as you said, Eli, on the same day that PSA announced it was moving its headquarters to Charlotte. Well, after months of disputes and back and forth over who won the race for the seat on the North Carolina State Supreme Court and on which votes should or should not be counted, the contest between Democratic incumbent Justice Allison Riggs, who is ahead by 734 votes, and Republican challenger Judge Jefferson Griffin, made its way to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals this week in what was described as a, quote, wonky and remarkably confusing 94-minute hearing on Monday. The three-judge panel heard from attorneys on both sides. But this wasn't about the case itself. Rather, it was about which court should be dealing with this. Nick, is that accurate?
That is accurate. This particular 94 minutes, and when you have an hour and a half of debating whether or not the people hearing a case can actually legally hear a case, I think that is the definition of wonky or confusing. But let's not let that detract from the overall importance and high stakes that are at play here if this legal theory being advanced in this overall challenge is to get any merit in the courts at all.
So the three-judge panel is comprised of Paul Niemeyer. He's an appointee of George H.W. Bush, Toby Haytens, who was appointed by President Biden, and Marvin Quattlebaum, a Trump-appointed judge. And from their questioning of the attorneys on both sides, Can you glean, could you glean anything about which way they may or may not be leaning?
I think reading, just assessing the questions, which take that for what it's worth. I think the judges during the argument did not seem to agree and were coming at it from different angles. But I think in these kinds of cases, you speculate at your own peril.
I suppose for those, go ahead, Eli, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I tried to listen to that hearing. I'm not a lawyer, but I like to consider myself a smart dude, and I've listened to a lot of legal hearings as my time as a reporter. And when they started talking about debating the Quackenbush standard, I checked out. I couldn't make heads or tails of it after that.
Yeah. I suppose for the benefit of people who may not know what we're talking about because they don't follow the news as closely as we do, we should recap what this is about. We have these two individuals, a Democratic incumbent justice on the Supreme Court running against a judge. And the judge, even though she's ahead by 734 votes after several bipartisan recounts, the judge, the Republican, is challenging 60,000 votes or 5,000 votes, and now he's focusing in on 500 votes. Is that what they're going to consider when the case finally is decided? Which court gets it? Is that what they're going to decide, whether or not to throw out these votes?
Can I step back one half of a second, a little bit more here without being too wonky myself? Is that at issue here are those votes, and he's challenging basically federal laws that for years and years have allowed those votes to be cast and counted. All of them, the State Board of Elections have said, were cast legally and validly, and we can get into why that is. But so Judge Griffin wants to bring his challenge in state courts, and he ultimately thinks under the assumption or presumption that he would get a friendly venue at the Republican-controlled North Carolina Supreme Court. That court last week said, no, you need to go back to the trial court in state court. At the same time, Justice Riggs, the Democrat, has tried to remove this challenge to federal court because some of the laws being challenged are federal voting laws. And so this week's argument was whether the state court or the federal court should have control over this case. It is moving simultaneously on both tracks.
You talk about wonky. And if he gets more favorable treatment in North Carolina with the North Carolina State Supreme Court, because it's all Republicans except for two people, and Allison Riggs is one of the two, this Fourth Circuit Court has a dominant Republican balance. It's 2-1, Republican to Democrat. And I understand that the Bush-appointed judge, Judge Niemeyer, appeared sympathetic to Griffin's efforts to move the case to state court, while the Biden-appointed judge, Toby Hatens, appeared more sympathetic to arguments from Allison Riggs' attorneys to make it a federal case, not a state case, which makes Trump-appointed judge Quattlebaum the possible decider here. Which way did he appear to lean? Hard to tell.
You're asking questions that I'm not equipped to answer for you.
Okay. So what will happen next if the Fourth Circuit Court, the federal court, decides that state courts should handle this case?
Then it goes back to the trial court, because again, we had that ruling from the North Carolina Supreme Court last week, saying that it should, if in the state proceeding, should go back and start at the trial court level before it works its way back up to the North Carolina Supreme Court. And by the way, you know, we can look at the presidents who appointed judges, and we can look at, you know, how in North Carolina the judges are elected and what parties they belong to, and that can be instructive. But my experience with judges are that they are not as partisan as the rest of society would like to make them seem.
I know Ben wants to chime in on this, but Ben, you'll have to wait because we're going to a break, and there's no stopping us. There's no stopping us. Once we set our minds to a break, we take it. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo is here, senior editor for WFAE News. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands is reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. We've been talking about the Fourth Circuit Court taking the case or deciding on which level of the court system should handle this dispute between Allison Riggs and Jefferson Griffin, who are running for a seat on the state Supreme Court. And Ben, you wanted to chime in, I believe.
Yes, an interesting aside here. This week we spoke to new state auditor Dave Bolick. That's notable because he's a Republican. And now, because of that new law passed by the General Assembly about 2 months ago, he is now in charge of the State Board of Elections, which is new. It used to be the governor. Now it's the state auditor. So this is a new change. So we spoke to him about it in general, about his job, some of his new responsibilities because of this law. And we asked him if he felt like November's election, generally speaking, which he ran in, was fair and safe. And he said yes, that he had no reason to believe that had not been run fairly or had not been safe, which is interesting because he's a Republican. And he's now the guy in charge of State Board of Elections saying, hey, this election was safe and fair.
A hearing is already set in Wake County Superior Court for 10 a.m. on February the 7th, no matter what the Fourth Circuit Court decides, I guess. And that court is historically more favorable, I am told, to Democrats. If they get the case and they rule against Griffin's request to throw out the 60,000 votes he says should not be allowed, is he likely to appeal this to the state Supreme Court?
Yes, and that was essentially the crux of their ruling. And we won't get into what that ruling actually was involving a writ. Last week was basically, you might get back to us later, but for now, you need to start at the bottom, like everyone else.
So what happens if the Fourth Circuit Court decides that, yes, this should be handled by a federal court and not a state court? What happens then?
Presumably, the feds would take it and it would move. It is worth noting that typically, cases move much more expeditiously in federal court than state court.
And it all, then that won't be the end, because, you know, there will be appeals after that, too. Well, so in any case, it's not going to be over.
That's what I was going to say next. It looks like no decision in this case will be final, because if the case gets kicked back to state court, Paul Niemeyer, a H.W. Bush appointee, suggested that the case could have an even longer road ahead. He said, quote, if somebody contends that the action by the Supreme Court of North Carolina is null and void because it should have been in federal court, they can appeal the North Carolina Supreme Court decision to the Supreme Court of the United States. In the meantime, since she is an incumbent, can Allison Riggs hear cases as a justice on the state Supreme Court? Or because her term, I guess, ended before the last election, is she allowed to sit on the bench? Do we know?
That is a good question.
I would assume, Mike, that because, you know, every time you get elected, you have to get a new commission and a new swearing in. So I would assume she did. I don't know this, though. And so the phone lines are open. Callers, not really. Call and tell us if you know. But that is a good question. I would assume she does not have a commission to currently sit as a justice. Okay.
And that race, has not been certified and right. all that by okay. by the state. One thing I just wanted to say really quickly, I just keep having flashbacks or thinking, man, this is what we were all worried about happening with the presidential election and presidential right. results in swing states. So I feel like in some ways we've either dodged a bullet that it's happening with just one race and not the presidential race, or we're getting a dark preview of what more and more and more races might end up like in the coming years.
And we should say that the groundwork for these challenges was actually filed in lawsuits before the election by Republicans and on behalf of the Republican Party in the event of a different outcome in the presidential race. So, but despite that, these theories that are being used to challenge the election are novel and could be very impactful if they're upheld.
So one more thing to touch on before we leave this topic. The Fourth Circuit Court, a reminder here, is deciding on proper jurisdiction. They are not deciding on the merits of the case. And since we spoke about this last week, Judge Griffin, who is trying to get the courts to throw out 60,000 votes in all, or 5,000 in particular, which seem to be votes in heavily Democratic areas, has continued to narrow his focus. He has made court filings asserting that more than 500 people who have never lived in North Carolina or in the United States voted in the November 5th election contest. If any court at any level decides that Judge Griffin's in his favor, would that not change the outcome of many of the other already decided elections? Or could the courts mandate that this decision to throw out votes only applies to the Riggs-Griffin race?
It would create a can of worms. And Mike, that sentence that you said about those 500 people he's challenging are all true, but they are still United States citizens. We should just say that these are people who were born to U.S. citizens abroad and have never lived in the country. And so by law, you still have a right to vote because you're still a citizen. And so your kind of citizenship and residency is a better term, attaches to where your parents' residency is, because again, when you are an American citizen living overseas, you still have a right to vote. And so this is one class of people who are being challenged. Another class, the 5,000, are actually service members. Many are service members who voted absentee in this election. And so these are the kinds of people whose votes, who lawfully voted, whose votes he is challenging.
Okay, so we'll keep our eye on that because it will go on forever, probably till 2029. The Mecklenburg County Commission went on their annual budget retreat to Winston-Salem this week to talk about the county's financial status, and they were told that due to rising costs, the county faces a $61 million increase in anticipated local spending, and that number, according to Dina DiOrio, the county manager, could continue to increase. Was this unexpected, Eli?
I don't think so. It's a similar dynamic to what we saw the last go around. Again, it's largely the same. Costs have gone up. Wages have gone up. Inflation has gone up. The biggest contributor to these rising costs are employee costs, which everyone has seen increases not just in wages, but also in things employers pay like health premiums. So the county is saying, hey, look at this. We're going to need probably at least this much extra money, or offset with spending cuts, which is not really being talked about. And I'll note that that number is preliminary. It could still increase as they get more of a detailed picture from the other bodies that they help fund, like Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools.
And last year, the commission approved a budget that necessitated a modest property tax increase. And Commission Chair Mark Jarrell says another may be on the way.
We're in a belt-tightening spot this fiscal year, the upcoming fiscal year. And so it is what it is, unless we want to consider a tax increase.
So that means one is coming, one would presume. But could they avoid this by doing some belt-tightening? Which way are they likely to go?
Well, I, again, like federal judges, hesitate to predict the actions of local commissions, but I haven't seen any appetite for people wanting to cut. Most of what they're talking about are things that will take more money, like buying more land for parks, paying employees more. So, you know, if you just want to read the tea leaves and say, is anyone talking about cuts, putting cuts on the table? No. So I think they probably are leaning towards increase. Keep in mind, there are already some modest tax increases baked into the next few years to pay off that $2.5 billion CMS bond that local schools borrowed for school updates and construction.
When will they make their decision?
So the fiscal year runs through June, and you know they've got to decide in the months before that exactly what they'll do. So they usually decide in late spring, early summer.
Okay, so last week we talked about the four scenarios that CATS interim CEO Brent Cagle presented to the Metropolitan Transit Commission for transit expansion. After public input, they have to choose one of those plans to present to the General Assembly, hat in hand, to ask them for permission to put a 1-cent sales tax referendum for transit on the November ballot. Alex, All four of these plans would include the Red Line to Davidson and beyond. The others focus on permutations of the Silver Line with or without a train, expansion of the Blue Line south to Ballantyne with or without a train, the use of bus rapid transit, expansion of the streetcar, the Gold Line streetcar, and expansion and betterment, improvement in the bus system. We spent an hour yesterday with Brent Cagle talking about all of this, and he told us that buses are the heart and soul of any transit system anywhere. So how would any of these scenarios improve bus transit?
They all improve bus transit. All of them, like you said, the Red Line is included in all the scenarios, and also the Gold Line streetcar. And they want to make sure in every single scenario that they include $522 million to improve the bus system. That means making the frequencies better so that people can, they aren't waiting as long at bus stops, and they're able to catch their ride sooner. And also making sure that they have really good shelters and benches. A lot of the majority of, or 30% of the stops in the Charlotte system right now are just signs. So those are the ones that you're passing where it's like grassy overlook. Overgrown grass, and people are just standing there at signs. Sometimes they're like turning over a grocery cart or something so that they can have somewhere to sit while they wait. So those are some improvements that will just make the bus system more reliable, and then also provide the comfortable transportation to reach the rail lines if that's not something that's, you know, if you're not living right on the Blue Line tracks, for example. Yeah,
microtransit. We talked a little bit about that with Brent. Microtransit. Expansion of the Gold Line streetcar is also part of these four scenarios, yet respondents who took a survey in December and January ranked the Gold Line lowest on their list of priorities. Alex, why is Katz keen on expanding something that people don't care about and aren't riding?
A few reasons. One, they want to make sure that they're actually addressing all these corridors that they committed to when they came up with these transit plans years ago. And the Gold Line make sure that they get some of the west side, some of the east side. Another thing is that it's not a small amount of money, but smaller compared to a project like the Silver Line. The Silver Line, you're looking at $6.9 billion. Whereas extending the Gold Line is $845 million. And then I also think that Katz is very confident that they can make people like the Gold Line. They have some plans to try to give it signal priority or to try to fix the issues of like cars parking and blocking its way. And if they can accomplish some of those goals, it will make that ride more reliable. And then they could probably get ridership up even more. And ridership has been going up.
So, Ben, I know you want to get on this, but I'm fighting the clock, so make it fast.
I would just make the case for the Gold Line as somebody who rides it with some regularity. It could be so much better if you put some of that signal prioritization in it, if you gave it its own lane, if you allowed it to skip stops. There are so many ways to make it so much better.
And you ride it?
Yeah, I do. I would say not on a daily or weekly basis, but I do ride it. I would say every month, something like that. Yeah.
He rides it because it's free.
I didn't see a unicorn horn there, but we have a unicorn on this show.
There you go.
After they make a decision on which plan they're going to present to Raleigh, if passed, that would allow us to put this referendum on the ballot in November with voters saying yes or no to a 1 cent sales tax. Even if that happens, voters here in the past have been known to reject referenda. They rejected the idea of building an uptown arena. They said no to an arts funding package. So I asked Brent Cagle, what if voters say no to this?
We start to analyze why they said no, and we learn from that experience. What I think, though, is unlike arts or arenas, transit is critical to the community. We hear that over and over. Roads are critical to the community. So I don't know, you know, I don't know. People will vote their conscience, and I don't know if that'll be a yes or a no. But I think when it comes to transit and roads, this is critical for our community as we continue to grow.
Do you think you're selling that? Because it seems to me that you're going to get one shot at this. If they say no, I don't think you're going to come back on the next election cycle and do it again, right?
Well, we certainly want this to pass first time around.
And of course, City Councilman Malcolm Graham has said there is no plan B to this. Residents in the northern part of the county were adamant about opposing any plan that didn't include the red line. They got the red line. Now Matthews is upset about not getting the silver line. Do they have the numbers? Because it appeared that people in the northern part of the county, had they said no to this, that would have killed it. So do the people in Matthews have enough population or political clout to kill it?
Well, I think that's one reason that the city wants to get this passed in Raleigh so they can get a referendum arranged quickly so they have enough time to spin up a good yes campaign with the business community, because, you know, this is going to be, if it happens, an off-year election where you have very low turnout. So small numbers can make a big difference.
So meanwhile, WFAE Steve Harrison, who's been reporting on transit forever, reported yesterday on an apparent reversal of what Katz has been saying about building a new uptown bus station. When the Hornets were involved in putting their practice facility in the same building, Katz officials touted the wisdom and the need for putting a bus station underground. But the Hornets decided to build their own facility, and now Katz has abandoned the idea of putting it underground, not just because of the Hornets, but also because the cost of the project, according to Brent Cagle, was estimated to have increased by $20 million or more. And there are other reasons, too. And despite years of Katz telling us underground was the best solution, Cagle now says, not so.
All things being equal, it is always better to have a transit facility at grade. It's easier for operators. The facility itself is easier to maintain air quality, all of those things. And so while it's absolutely possible, and there are many transit facilities that are below grade that are very successful, the fundamental truth has always been the same. All things being equal, at grade is better.
But that's not what Katz has been saying. Katz officials keep saying keeping it at grade or street level would not work. Now suddenly it does.
Well, I'm not sure who said it wouldn't work, but I think we have a long history of showing that it absolutely does work and can work at grade.
So I don't have a question about this, but does anybody have anything to add to this?
You know, I've been covering transit in this city for a long time, and it's really... I feel refreshing to hear Brent Cagle just basically say what a lot of people thought was common sense. We've written a lot of articles about it here, and it's like, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense.
Alex?
I was just going to add, like, if you think about the transportation center now, you have the gold line going next to it and then the blue line going above it. And the whole thing is kind of complicated. So I think putting the buses below ground and having like three different levels of different types of transit would be, I'm not sure, the best option.
When we come back, CMS reading scores better than national average. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Nick Oxner is here from WBTV, where he is the chief investigative reporter there. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And our own Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Eli, American children have a reading problem.
This is a major concern, a concern that cannot be blamed solely on the pandemic. This is not just a pandemic story. Our nation is facing complex challenges in reading.
That's Peggy Carr. She's the commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics, referring to the fact that the number of students hitting the basic achievement level for reading has dropped nationally, with the gap between white and black and or Hispanic students continuing to widen. But that is not the case, evidently, at CMS. Eli, what's the story there?
Well, it's more of a mixed bag. CMS in reading scores, we're higher than some of our comparable large urban districts, but still flat or a little lower than pre-COVID. Math, there are some areas where we're higher or than our peers or flat. But there are also some discouraging statistics there, too. Like, for example, the number of eighth graders reaching math basic proficiency. It was 64%, and now it's down to 59%. So that's moving in the wrong direction. And, you know, it's been 5 years since COVID started, and I think you're starting to see a debate about whether we're seeing the continuation of those trends and those impacts, or whether it's been so long that we can't point the finger at COVID anymore and there's some more serious underlying problems still showing up.
Does anybody have a theory about why these test scores continue to fall? Why kids can't read? Or is it that they can't read? Or is it they don't understand what they read? Comprehension. I mean, what's the problem, and does anybody know why?
Well, State Superintendent Mo Green was saying this week that the test results he hopes will improve in North Carolina because so many teachers have now been retrained in the teaching method called science of reading, which is supposed to be a big improvement over other reading models and is supposed to be a real back to basics phonics, helping kids read. You know, that won't be reflected for a few years. Also, if you look at who these tests sample, you've got samples of eighth graders and samples of fourth graders. Eighth graders 5 years ago, when there was remote learning, they were in third grade. Fourth graders were either in kindergarten or preschool. So even though it's been a long time since the pandemic started, you are still sampling cohorts of kids who were really right in the middle of it, and in some cases saw more than 1 year of their basic schooling disrupted by the pandemic. And, you know, I think you can make a case that losing a year of kindergarten or first grade in person, maybe that really hurts you a lot more than losing, you know, a 12th grade year.
So although CMS scores are slightly above the national average, they're still not very good. And that's something that Beth Thompson, the Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer at CMS, acknowledges, which is why she says they are focused on improvement.
I think part of the reason that our community and our Board of Education has set two of our four district goals for the next 5 years around literacy is an acknowledgement of A, how important that is, and B, how much we want to continue to work on the ability of our students to be able to think critically.
She also mentioned that perhaps they could implement strategies like contacting districts across the country to see what they are doing to be successful. But we're beating the national average. Who's she going to talk to?
I believe San Diego, I think, was one that had, you know, better trends than us. There are some, you know, even though we're above average, there are other places to look at. But really, you know, I think you need to start looking at fundamental questions like, are we able to attract the best educators with the teaching salaries that we have now? You know, these are not new issues. These are the things you hear about. But clearly, all these years after the pandemic and with the science of reading changes, things are not moving in the right direction, and flat is being hailed as a victory.
You know, from the shortage of employees in air traffic control towers, the shortage of school bus drivers, the shortage of teachers, the shortage of firefighters, the shortage of police officers, much of which all points back to money, a shortage of money, not enough people being paid enough. That all goes back to taxes. We've been busy cutting taxes for years. And as one city manager or county manager in Mecklenburg County told me 100 years ago, taxes equal services. We seem to have forgotten that. The CMS school board this week approved a new pay schedule. Not that I'm advocating for higher taxes. I'm just saying that's what it is.
We'll send you the bill.
Yeah. The CMS school board this week approved a new pay schedule for staff, raising the minimum wage to $20 per hour. Which staff members does this impact, Eli?
So it's about 5,000 staff members. They are largely support staff called classified staff. They're hourly workers. Like janitors, teacher's assistants, after-school site coordinators, and many of them have not been making $20 an hour. They will now. The pay increase is also retroactive.
It's about 5,000 workers at a cost of about $26 million. The vote was unanimous on the school board with CMS board member Monty Witherspoon among them.
I think this is huge. This is not just political action. This is really justice work that's going to make a huge difference in people's lives. It's a huge step in the right direction.
Where's the $26 million coming from?
I believe they have that available in their current budget. I will confess I'm not totally up on the mechanics of that. I also think it's really interesting that just a few years ago we were talking about movements like the Fight for 15 and the $15 minimum living wage. And, you know, from hospitals to bank tellers to schools now, the 20 is really the new floor.
So in November of last year, WBTV obtained a copy of a letter sent by then Chief Deputy Kevin Canty to Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden. It was a resignation letter in which he was highly critical of the manner in which McFadden runs the sheriff's department. Nick, remind us of what that letter said.
Well, I think it can be summed, the sentiment of the letter can be summed up pretty well by Canty's sentence and what he told my colleague Naomi Coles and when he talked to her about that letter. He called the sheriff's office a third world dictatorship, or said that's how McFadden ran the office. He alleged retaliation and toxic workplace environment. He questioned the sheriff's handling of internal investigations and internal affairs. And these are questions and complaints that he raised, but that he alone does not, he shares with many other former employees of the sheriff's office.
Yeah, he wrote in that letter, and I quote, "It has become painfully obvious that you intend to run this agency into the ground and completely demoralize the men and women of this agency." Others have come forward since that letter to talk about and say similar things. What has been the sheriff's response to this over the last several months?
He vehemently denies that there's any wrongdoing and has said that he will continue to work to be better, generally speaking.
Some thought that Sheriff McFadden would ultimately resign as more and more of these accusations trickled out, but this week he shut down any speculation of that. Alex, you spoke with him for Axios Charlotte. What did he say?
Yeah, I asked him directly if he had felt any pressure to resign, and he said no, he didn't. And I said, are you going to run again? And he basically said he was considering it and kind of like, why not? Why wouldn't I? I still have work to do. So he is still feeling really confident about the way that he runs the organization, despite some of these allegations from former employees.
The story, in addition to being on WBTV, was also published in the Charlotte Observer, and though the sheriff says he did not read that article, he characterized the Observer's coverage as being unfair, attacked the media. What did he find about it that was unfair?
I think that his main concern is that these are employees that no longer work for him, so the Observer should have contacted people who are more pleased with his management and who work under him right now.
And he told you, he's quoted in your coverage as saying, quote, "This is a very progressive, a well-balanced, and a well-structured sheriff's office led by me. But here's what the problem is. I am a bold, straightforward, no-nonsense leader." Having had conversations with him, I can tell you he can be direct. Can some people take it that way, just being too curt and wanting to get things done now, as opposed to taking a slower approach?
Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, yeah, I think that it depends person to person. And I think that's why this conversation was so interesting to me. Like me and Sheriff McFadden, we talked about this for a while, kind of like how he's really losing faith in the media because he feels like there's just so many negative reports, and he thinks that also makes it hard on his deputies because they're constantly like defending themselves or defending the office or being asked about it. But he's been doing this for 40 years, and he's quite the institution here. But so I think that's why at this point it was interesting that he's now saying things like, I'm going to start my own news channel, because he can't, because he's had such a bad 2024 between investigations about deaths in the jail, to now these allegations coming out about employees, to an audio recording that surfaced with him saying derogatory language.
Yeah, we should mention that prior to his being sheriff, he was with the CMPD, and during that time, he also had his own television show, and I think it was a nationally syndicated television show. Nick, did you want to jump in there before we move on?
No, we can.
Okay. So meanwhile, the Trump administration has launched their promised deportation efforts around the country, and last week, the Department of Justice released a memo calling for the investigation of state and local law enforcement officials who do not enforce Donald Trump's immigration policy, saying local officials who obstruct immigration policies could face prosecution by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Would that be legal?
Well, their theory is that the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution elevates federal law above state laws. And if you, you know, are an official in law enforcement and you don't comply with the federal law, then, yeah, they would say you're obstructing them, and that can be a crime. As far as I know, it hasn't been tested in this particular case, but, you know, there will certainly be tests.
So I bring that up because Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden is among several Democratic sheriffs around the state who refused to cooperate with ICE and the 287G program during the previous Trump administration. McFadden says he believes that doing so, or he believed that doing so then, would have been in violation of the law. Is that cooperation mandated this time, and is he cooperating this time?
So 287G was a voluntary program. Sheriffs could decide whether or not they wanted to participate. Now, since House Bill 10 has been passed into law in North Carolina, there is a mandatory standard for local jails to cooperate with immigration authorities. Sheriff McFadden says he is following the state law and is complying with everything HB 10 requires.
And that's why he told WFAE then that his office is not under threat of investigation or prosecution because it abides by federal and state immigration enforcement policies. And he insists that the Department of Justice's memo was directed to sanctuary cities, of which Charlotte is not one. We're going to skip ahead because we're short on time here. The General Assembly is back in session with Hurricane Helene relief at the top of their to-do list. Senate Majority Leader Phil Berger spoke to Triangle Area's CBS 17.
One of the most important things that we have to do is figure out what's the appropriate thing or way for us to deal with the Western North Carolina circumstances.
There's a new committee formed to deal specifically with recovery. The vice chair of that committee, Representative Ray Pickett, a Republican from District 93, says he thinks that people want to know when the help is coming. Why are they still waiting? Why didn't the General Assembly come back to handle this before the official start of the session?
Well, they passed multiple bills last year. I interviewed new House Speaker Destin Hall this week and asked a version of that question. He said they've been waiting to see what Congress is going to do with funding, to see how much federal dollars and what that money was going to go for, so that their next bill, which he said would probably come in a few weeks in February, that could then either match where matching funds are needed or fill in gaps where the federal dollars aren't going to flow.
And it should be mentioned that this has bipartisan support in both houses. Sidney Batch leads the North Carolina State Senate Democrats and spoke to CBS 17. In the Triangle.
At a minimum, we need to, of course, talk about our neighbors out west and make sure that we can go ahead and fund all of the necessary resources that they need out there.
Now, Trump has criticized FEMA, and he's been critical of government response to this disaster in general. Is the state coordinating with the federal government to increase aid quickly, or is all of the chaos in these early days of the Trump administration actually leading to confusion at the state level?
I just want to say, for perspective here, they're estimating it's going to cost between $50 and $60 billion.
Right.
And just for some context, the state budget last year was $30 billion, the entire state budget, and they're needing $50 to $60. So we are a long, long, long way off from the necessary money that they're going to need in Western North Carolina.
This special committee is examining the best way to help with recovery, and it's expected to make recommendations that lead to more state funding. New Republican House Speaker Destin Hall told WUNC the state wants to make sure that they don't add any redundancy to what the federal government may or may not do.
What they're doing is studying. We don't want to overlap with what the federal government's doing. We want to make sure we're being efficient and not spending things on the same thing the feds are going to do. And so where we need to get money quickly, we're going to do that.
So when will they have a decision on this, more funding?
Again, Speaker Hall told me that they expect the next bill to be in February in a couple of weeks. And that's when he talks about it, he means things like paying to replace private roads and bridges, which FEMA funding isn't going to go for. It's going to go for state roads.
Perfect. And Ben, before we were on the air, you told me that Destin Hall, the new Speaker of the House in North Carolina, had some good things to say about our new governor, Josh Stein, a Democrat, different party. How can this be?
Yeah, I think
he did on camera, no less.
But I'm sorry, Ben, what?
Nick was talking about that. Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. I'm sorry. I misattributed it to you. Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Eli Portillo from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.